BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, I'm on a Skype call this morning with a recovering banker by the name of Michael Jordaan. Michael, of course, is the former CEO of First National Bank. He stepped down from the bank at the end of 2013 to pursue his interests in, among other things, startups, technology, and wine farming. We're going to chat today about some of the investments that Michael has made in recent years, have a look at Rain, the new LTE advanced operator in South Africa, and then steer the conversation towards cryptocurrencies. So a lot to get through today. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Duncan.
It's our pleasure. First of all, I have to ask, which is more financially rewarding, the wine farm or investing in technology?
Duncan, wine farms are about passion, lifestyle, heritage, and physical products, which is something I never had in banking, but they're certainly not about positive cash flow.
Okay.
I suppose startup investing also consumes cash, particularly initially, but products are intangible, and ultimately they have much better growth prospects, especially when it comes to scale, and ultimately financial benefits should flow from that, which it doesn't in a wine farm.
Okay, so it's more a labor of love, if you like.
Exactly.
Okay. Tell me, do you miss the banking industry at all? You've been out of it for, what, about 4 years or so now?
I don't miss the lifestyle. It was an all-consuming job that took every waking hour of my day. What I do miss is that I had a great team. I miss my team. Plus the intellectual stimulation which one gets from being at the center of the economy. And that's what banks are, and it's what's always drawn me to banking is, you know, it's at the center of everything. Fortunately, tech startups are similar. The founders are highly competent, so there's stimulation there, they're energetic, they are hugely ambitious, they want to change the world. I'm involved in about 20 different companies. And the nice thing for me is that my involvement is strategic, but not operational. And again, you can imagine if you have 9 million customers, which we had at FNB, or 33,000 people, there's always an issue and there's always stress and there's always something wrong.
Yeah.
And, I get to go to work in shorts, I'm unshaven. So I can really focus on substance and not form. And that's a big difference between startups and the corporate world.
Okay. Now, you've invested in a wide range of tech startups. There's 21 of them now, is that right?
That's exactly right. It's just like the American band 21 Pilots, but it's the right figure for me. It's a good diversification. In fact, if you read the books, you need about 20 different investments because some of them are just not going to make it. Of course, I know some won't, but yes, it's right now I've got 21 startups and I enjoy all of them.
Great. Well, tell us a bit about your investment philosophy. If I'm a startup and I'm interested in approaching you for potential investment, what are the specific things you look for? What are the most important investment criteria for Michael Jordaan?
The first point I want to make, and it's like a broader point, I suppose, to all youngsters or all entrepreneurs there, is don't just follow your passion. You know, you see a lot of people who approach you with just an idea or just a dream, and it's their passion, and don't just come with yet another app. It's very, very difficult to enter the app market right now. You know, people just don't download new apps. The things that tickle me and that I also think the country needs is when somebody has found a problem, particularly a big problem, but they found a problem and they're solving it in a way that customers will pay them for it. Because my basic philosophy is that the biggest problems in the world also the biggest opportunities. I mean, just to use one example, I do believe in global warming. I know there are denialists out there, but instead of, you know, just tweeting about your concerns about what we're doing to the earth, a company like Tesla is making a big difference. They've come up with a business model where instead of burning fuel, you use electricity. And in this way, everything from education, which is a problem in South Africa, to health, which is a problem, to unemployment, I believe there are entrepreneurial solutions to make the world in South Africa a bit better. So I don't want to sound like a bleeding heart. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur and I want to back entrepreneurs, but I do think that startups are the best way to make the world better. And that those are the ones that I'm interested in.
Okay. You mentioned global warming and the use of electricity. I want to get back to that a bit later in the podcast when we talk about cryptocurrencies. But in your investments, is there a theme to them? Do you, I mean, with your background in financial services, are you particularly excited, for example, about the fintech space? Have you made investments in that area? Is there a bias towards cloud computing? Is there a particular theme to your investment style?
I initially started out knowing nearly nothing. Obviously, I corporate experience to fall back on, and I know from that experience that individuals are everything, people is everything in life. So basically, I started and the application started coming in quite immediately, and I just learned through the process. Mm. Incidentally, in Silicon Valley, they say that it takes $60 million to train a venture capitalist. That's the amount of money you need to put at risk and sometimes lose before you really know what's happening. And I'm still learning. You asked about fintech. That wasn't my initial focus. I suppose particularly because of loyalty. You know, you don't just leave something that was your baby and part of your life for so many years and start competing with them.
Right.
But over time, it's something I do want to do. Mm-hmm. There's one interesting fintech called Numerical. It's actually got capitals, NMRQL. We've now spent 3 years testing machine learning in the markets, and we're ready to come out, and unit trust will be launching next month. So I suppose that's one of my first ventures into fintech after my career at FNB.
So what is your view of the broad fintech? I mean, it seems to become a bit of a buzzword over the last couple of years. Do you believe that some of the startups in the space have the potential to transform the traditional financial services banking sector?
Sure, they do. And as a venture capitalist, sometimes you measure yourself by how well your portfolio does, but we should all be measuring ourselves by those opportunities we miss, that, you know, those companies that are going to do well, and definitely there are many of them around there. It is a difficult space. It's quite crowded. Also, the big companies, all the incumbents, essentially are also fintech players. I mean, a bank is a technology company nowadays, as is an insurance company. Mm. So the question is really how one could leverage new technology to do something maybe cheaper, maybe more efficient, maybe give better customer service. If I may just use Numerical as an example, it's machine learning formulae and algorithms that we believe can outperform the market, so it can do better than humans, but can also do so at a lower cost because you don't have to pay huge salaries, and can do so with better risk management because, you know, these things are built into an algorithm. So it's the type of model that we are willing to back because we believe it can outperform what existing incumbents do. So it's quite a crowded market. I would advise, you know, people who start up to think very, very clearly about the fact that you can't just make something incrementally better. It's got to be significantly better than what the current customer experience is, either cheaper or easier to execute. But you have examples in the market like Zapper and SnapScan, which I use on a daily basis, and I find it extremely convenient. So there's room for a whole lot more of those things because the big incumbents just aren't always in the position to react quickly enough and bring those things to market.
Yeah, I love SnapScan and Zapper. I use them all day as well. Fantastic products. Michael, the investments that you've made, are these companies that have approached you with ideas, with the view to getting funding, or do you also go into the market looking for opportunities and approach companies that you may be interested in investing in? What's the approach? Do companies come to you mainly?
Duncan, I suppose I'm privileged in that regard, but I really get more applications than I could ever handle, nearly 10 a day.
Wow.
What that means is I simply do not have the capacity to have coffee with all of them, and for that reason needed to establish a little bit of a formality or process, not a long one, a 5-minute one, where people can apply through the Angel Hub website. It's a team I've partnered with, okay. Angel Hub, etc. And then based on that, I get to have a, you know, a filtered view on all these applications. People also don't have to wait too long to get a quick answer from me. Mm. So the answer is no, I haven't had to go out there yet. And frankly, I also don't want to, because actually, you know, when you approach somebody and with a request to make an investment in them, the price goes up significantly.
Of course, yes. But 10 applications a day, that's quite phenomenal.
Yeah, you know, look, some of them are real nonsense. Some of them come from all over the world. Some of them are just ideas. And, you know, this is the important thing. I love ideas. I'm a nerd or a geek or whatever you want to call me. So I fall for ideas. But a very important lesson I've learned is that ideas are actually of very little value. People completely overvalue ideas and completely undervalue execution or the ability to implement that ideas. Ideas are cheap. You can go onto the internet and probably Google idea and add any subject there, and you'll have hundreds of ideas on how to change the world or do it better. So the trick is in execution. And if you ask me for a sweet spot, where our sweet spot is, it's when there's a great founder or a great team that have a good idea. It doesn't have to be a great idea, but have executed it very well and in such a way that customers are willing to pay for it. Then you've got the company. And then people want to invest, because then your capital is used not to prove something, but it's actually used to grow the business. Mm. So that's where we want to play.
And so how involved are you in these startups? You say you're not operationally involved. You're involved from a strategic perspective. Do you meet with each of them every so often and brainstorm ideas or strategy, that sort of thing?
The typical VC model usually has it in quite a structured format. You typically have that a venture capitalist actually joins the board of a company. I tend to shy away from that a little bit just because of the regularity of boards and what it does to your diary. Mm. And I prefer to operate on a quite an informal basis. And what that in my case means is if they want me, they have access to me. And that can be via mail, it can be a phone call, that can then be a cup of coffee or a glass of wine. And where somebody just says, listen, these are the big issues in my business, and sometimes I can come up with value-added advice. And the important thing there, it's never an instruction, it really is a discussion, and hopefully I can give a little bit of a benefit of what I've seen in life or in business life. Mm. And, you know, if they just take up one or two of the ideas in a discussion like that, I hope that I've added value in that process. Now, I'm sure this approach of being a little bit of hands-off can be criticized. There are other investors that are far more hands-on. There are some entrepreneurs that maybe want somebody that they can speak to, I don't know, once a day or once a week. Mine is the more distance one, and I help when I get asked for help or where something clear crops up on my mind, and then I interact proactively.
Okay. Given the number of applications you get every day, and you say a lot of them are not worth considering, but it's still a phenomenal number, what does that say about the tech startup ecosystem in South Africa? Is it in a healthy space?
You know, I think everybody saw cool movies like The Social Network, where you saw a Zuckerberg drop out of Harvard, and it all looks like fun, and they drink a lot of tequila, and, you know, there's some pretty girls around and so on. And people hold the startup scene as in quite a romantic sphere, mm. You know, mm. something they want to do, which I think is cool. I think that too much of our generation has grown up by thinking your only career choice is to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. So I think it's really cool that there's a startup scene like that. I think it's just growing, probably still quite immature. I certainly can speak on behalf of the venture capital scene that I think it's, you know, very underdeveloped compared to some other markets in the world. But good things are happening. I think the major thing that I would tell people is to read a lot. There are a lot of entrepreneurs that, you know, you'll tell them, is that your MVP? And they'll say, well, what's an MVP? And I go, it's a minimum viable product. And it's like a basic concept if you want to run a lean startup. What's a lean startup? Well, a lean startup means that you can get to the market at the lowest cost possible and start testing your product and move from there, and you can do it quickly. And people don't know about these concepts. So they can still learn a lot about startups from the plethora of content that is available out there. It's nearly become a science now about how you can make your startup more successful. So I'm giving you two messages. One is it's big, much bigger than it ever used to be. It's still growing, all of which is positive. But in some ways, it's still quite immature, where people prefer to talk to other people and go to conferences and drink coffee when they get some really, really good guidelines from the content that's available for free out there.
Is there anything we as a country could and should be doing more to encourage the tech ecosystem? I mean, obviously, education is a huge thing, and I think we've seen a lot of startups coming out of Stellenbosch specifically, and I think that's to do, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's to do with the university there. What more as a country can we be doing to try and foster our own mini Silicon Valley, if you like?
Yes, Duncan. Stellenbosch has done well, as has Cape Town. I mean, I think there's a broader so-called Silicon Cape initiative, which encompasses both. And in the rest of the world, what we've seen is that having a world-class university as part of the ecosystem is very, very important because, you know, ultimately it's intellect that is behind all of these startups. Can we do more? Yes, of course, there's so much more that, you know, governments can do. And it's everything from making it easier to start a company. There are big discussions about IP, for example. It's quite restrictive taking South African IP out of the country when you want to go abroad. So there are quite good discussions with the Reserve Bank. I have to say that the Section 12J incentive for people to invest in startups, that's probably one of the more successful fiscal initiatives that have happened. But I think the biggest problem here is not so much government as it is culture, and it's the South African culture. And the biggest thing is probably that we shy away from risk and that we still have a stigma about failure. Now, I'm not saying you must fail stupidly. That's wrong. But many, many startups, many founders that have become very successful will tell you that if you don't take big risks, things aren't going to work out, and you need to be able to adapt and sometimes is another word, pivot, you know, kind of change your business strategy and take the learnings from failing and move on. So my message out there, if I again speak to youngsters or people who want to start a business, is that your risk that you take is going to correlate extremely well with the rewards that you get out of life. You can cut down on risk all the time, but you'll have quite a boring life, or you can cleverly increase your risk and your life will be better. So I think the biggest change that we need to have in South Africa is cultural, and that goes with risk. And then the other one is that the power is in your hands to do something about the issues you see in South Africa all around you. You can actually make the country better. That doesn't mean you don't have the right to point fingers at, you know, whoever you feel is doing things wrong. But instead of just pointing fingers, be proactive and do something about it. So both these things are cultural interventions that I think would be very beneficial.
And I suppose culture is probably the hardest thing to change.
That's right. One way to change it, those role models. I think we should celebrate it when, I don't know, Mark Shuttleworth has done well by, you know, selling his company, or some of the smaller startups. I don't know, when we mentioned SnapScan before, you know, they've had a nice exit. When they're good exits, I wish we would cover that a little bit more in the press than all the bad news, because our youth are looking for role models, and they can't just be disc jockeys or celebrities or, you know, people in idol contests. They really have to be entrepreneurs who start businesses. So a TV show like Dragon's Den, for example, I think those things are very positive because they show a completely new world to people who may have been unaware of it, that you can go out there and start something.
It always amazes me when I travel across to Silicon Valley how entrepreneurs there are and startups there are treated almost like rock stars. That's certainly not the case here in South Africa.
No, unfortunately not. But the nice thing about cultures is they do go across natural boundaries pretty quickly, and cultural boundaries. I mentioned the movie The Social Network before. You know, we were exposed to those same type of movies and we see those things. And if they happen over there, we do question whether they can't happen over here. And the world is changing faster and faster. Those cultural waves are coming to us much quicker than they did in the past. So look, I'm positive about the fact that you have a whole new generation of youngsters who are now considering being an entrepreneur quite seriously for the first time. When I grew up, there was no question about it. You studied hard and then you found yourself a good job. The world has changed.
Mm. Let's talk about some of those startups you've invested in. Are there one or two standouts that you've identified at this stage, ones that you believe have the potential to become major local or even global tech companies in the coming years?
Gee, Duncan, I'll probably get in trouble with any one of the 21 startups and the CEOs and team and each who will think that it's them. I think the one that is poised to make the biggest impact on South Africa is probably Rain. Now, it has the limitation that it probably can't grow abroad because it needs spectrum to do so. Mm. But in South Africa, there are big, big issues around data and connectivity. if you aren't connected to the internet, you are relegated to a second or third class citizen in the world, not just in South Africa, because you don't have access to news, to entertainment, to education. So it is really, really important that people get access to the internet, that data becomes faster, more affordable, and just more available to the big country. So we're very excited about RAIN, this mobile telco that we've announced. It hasn't launched in the market yet, but I think that'll make a big difference. Then I spoke to you about Numerical. The machine learning algorithms behind Numerical are generic. We happen to be launching them in the JSE, but they work in most of the markets that we've tested. And there are other companies like Essential Med, which looks at health insurance. There are lots of opportunities in Africa. I'm involved with CompuScan, which is a data bureau, and they're expanding in a whole lot of emerging markets, not just in Africa, but including the Philippines and Australia. I'm involved in Boss. You may know the iced tea brand.
Yes.
And what I really like there is that it's a truly South African thing, rooibos. It comes from South Africa, but there's a macro trend behind it, which is from coffee towards tea and towards iced tea. And there's another macro trend, which is towards more healthy drinks with lower sugar content. So I just, want to back something that I think is a South African champion. Mm. So all of these companies actually have incredible growth prospects, and it's just up to the team to deliver on them. And I have to say, it's a pleasure in investing in things like these, where your growth could be 10x or 10 times in a couple of years.
So it's all not all tech focused. I mean, investing in a drinks business, obviously not tech at all. So you're looking beyond the pure ICT market.
That's quite right. You see, technology in its broader definition, if you look it up, is just a better way of doing things. I think we've become quite focused on information technology, IT, but technology is just know-how, and that know-how can be about the brand or how to access the market. Of course, what information technology in its more focused sense allows you to do is to grow quite fast without a whole lot of increase in cost. Your marginal cost is quite low or zero once you've developed a software platform, say, for example. But I basically just look for opportunities where I can see massive growth opportunities. A lot of them aren't tech, but as I said, in the case of Boston, there are one or two others like artisanal chocolate and so on. Mm. I see a whole different growth thesis. So it's the growth that interests me rather than the tech that allows it in some cases.
Right. I'm interested in that you're also invested in the cloud space. You've got two investments there, one in a company called Alto Africa, which is focused on Microsoft technologies, and another one called Open Networks, which is focused on Google technologies. Is that a case of hedging your bets on who's likely to win the cloud race?
Well, I think both of them will win. Both of them obviously are aware that there's a kind of a quasi-conflict of interest, but they don't compete directly. As you said, the one's focused on Microsoft Cloud, the other one on Google Cloud. Mm. And basically what's happening here is that there's a trend of small businesses who up till now owned their own server, which costs a lot of money, who made their own backups, handled their own security. And the typical saving to them if they move from having their own server to the cloud is about 90%. That's the average cost saving for business. So this is actually quite a good example of how technology and or a new business model can bring a big benefit to small businesses. So because of that, I just think the trend is unstoppable. And this is why, some people are going to stay with Microsoft and save that money. Others are going to move to Google, and in some cases save even more money. And the market will decide. But both of them will win because the old business model is just so expensive and cumbensome.
Indeed. I've running my own small business, so the cloud is a no-brainer. Just putting everything in the cloud saves so much money.
Any startup would do it right from scratch. Mm. So it's just a matter of time until existing businesses follow the example.
Yeah, for sure. Let's shift the conversation now and chat about RAIN. We've touched on it already, but let's go into it in a bit more detail. You've invested in RAIN with your former colleague, another former top banker, Paul Harris, to build an LTE advanced wireless broadband network in South Africa. You're coming into what is already a pretty crowded market with big players like Vodacom and MTN. What exactly is RAIN hoping to do differently? What is your competitive differentiator relative to the big mobile operators?
Yes, Duncan, the names you mentioned are big, respected competitors. They have big brands. They have strong distribution and even a degree of customer inertia. Customers will you know, moan about what they pay on a monthly basis or data disappearing, but they're not that inclined to switch. So we respect that. At the same time, what differentiates us is, first of all, that we are a data-first operator.
Okay.
So data, it's 4.9G or what's known in the industry as LTE A Pro. And if you think of data first and data only, things like voice, which operators still make a lot of money out of, becomes just another app and it effectively becomes free. You and I are now talking via Skype, but we could do it via WhatsApp or via FaceTime. It's free other than for the very little data that you use. And it's the same for SMS. So the business models of most of these large telco operators are built on making money out of voice and out of SMS, where we say that should simply be free. And we want to only sell data. And we feel that with our new technology, we can make data much faster, more abundant, and more affordable. So that's what makes us different. Clearly, where we also have to catch up is in the amount of sites that we have out there. Today, as I talk to you, we have 1,200 sites. We're planning to have 2,000 by year end and 5,000 in 3 years' time. So we clearly still have to roll out those sites. But underlying this business, and you can even get it in its brand, RAIN, is that we feel data is a human right. You know, if people don't have access to the internet, they, as I said, are second-class citizens, and we don't want that. And more data in the economy will actually help the economy to grow. There are studies out there that say that a 10% increase in broadband access by the population adds about 1.3% to the economic growth every year. So South Africa truly needs economic growth, and we feel we can make a difference there too.
You've launched fixed wireless services through your partner, Internet Solutions, part of Dimension Data, which is in turn offering those products onward to a range of internet service providers, and those products are in the market already. Now, that's fixed wireless focused. I presume this is just the first phase of your plans. What's the longer term play here?
Yes, Duncan, you're exactly right. It's the first phase, and so we're clearly launching only in those areas where we have coverage right now. But then it's ideal to put a little box in your house with a SIM card in it and light it up with Wi-Fi. I mean, it's very fast. You know, we would try and get a minimum of 20 megabits a second, but the average is higher. And the advantage is you don't have to dig up your pavements. And we do believe that from a pricing perspective, we can also compete with fiber. We call ourselves fiber in the sky. But the longer term play with RAIN is to make it a full mobile operator. The only difference is that A, it will be data first, and B, that it will take us some time to get the coverage across the country that we need before we can launch it. We do want to do something before year end, but clearly that will be a limited functionality, or I should rather say limited coverage that we are able to offer at this stage. But for people, for example, who only live in metros and want to phone to other people who only live in metros, we think there's an advantage, particularly a price advantage, but also in the quality of the data that we can give them.
Okay. So in essence, you're becoming the fifth mobile operator in South Africa.
Yeah, I think technically that's right. We're number five. We prefer thinking of ourselves as number one, as a new mobile data first player,
right?
As an LTE player. So it's a different market segment. And that's the way we like to look at it, which I'm sure you understand.
Sure. Now, do you eventually end up serving customers, end-user customers directly, or do you continue with the internet solutions type model where you work through third parties? I know that going into that mass market is hellishly complex. Is that something you're planning to do, or will you work through a partner, say a company like a Blue Label Telecoms, or they might be a bad example given their investment in Cell C, but a distributor like that, or would you consider going direct?
We, as a matter of strategy, we're looking at all the options. So there will be a wholesale element. There will be MVNOs, which we'd like to enable. There will be retail, which could include retail partnerships. And yes, we do have ambitions of also going directly. If we do go directly, chances are that we will truly do it directly, you know, so that you can, for example, order your SIM cards and or your phone online, and it actually gets delivered to you, and the retail process is done in the same fashion. But we really are looking at all the possibilities. Our focus right now is more on getting that national coverage, so that, you know, when we go into the market, we have something proper to offer. But there's nothing holding us back, and that's one of the advantages of a startup, is you really start with a blank sheet. And you can think about doing things differently. We'd like to say that we think about it a little bit more like an internet company rather than a telco company. And so you can hear from that We'd like to go direct because you can cut out quite a lot of costs that intermediaries currently take out of the system.
Is there a particular customer segment that you're hoping to attract here, or is this going to be a national mass market offering?
Well, right now, LTE is only available on certain smartphones, so that already limits the market. So clearly, there's either these devices that you have in your house when it's so-called fixed mobile, which is quite a funny term I've learned because it sounds contradictory to me, but you know, you put a box in your house with a SIM card and you have Wi-Fi. So that's a very specific device, and then there are only very specific smartphones that can take LTE or 4G and above. So clearly that's something we need, that's our defined target market. Fortunately, however, the sale of smartphones is increasing. More than half of all new phones sold today are smartphones, and most of them are LTE enabled. So it's just a matter of time until most of South Africa do operate on data. And that's the very interesting change that's happening in the telco market as we move from voice and SMS as the primary driver to data. Now, clearly, that's a market that is not only available, that is owned currently by the existing operators, but we want to therefore go for the slightly higher tech user and people who understand the benefits that they can, for example, make a WhatsApp call or a Skype call, and it costs them nearly nothing compared to existing phone calls.
Right. Okay. So you're clearly a proponent of wireless technologies. I had a fascinating interview with Neil Schoeman on Friday. He's the CEO of fiber to the home provider Vumatel, and they've announced plans to go into townships, offering uncapped 100 megabit per second fiber to all dwellings, starting in Alex, but hoping to expand to a range of other townships around the Gauteng region next year at a price of 89 rand a month. I'm trying to get your views on this. There's been a sort of a perception in this industry that it's impossible to deliver fixed lines into low-income communities, yet Vumatel is now saying they've worked out a business model to do this. Do you think it's workable, and what is the future mix between fixed line and wireless in this country?
So I think Neil's announcement is very exciting, and it's exciting because it sounds very affordable, and I like the fact that it's unlimited. And maybe what's most exciting, it's going to townships where a big amount of the South African population have been excluded from the benefits of the internet, and they are data hungry. And I think the consumption, if he gets it right, will be huge. And I think the social benefits will be more than putting in fiber into the residential township, because those guys in the leafy suburbs already have access to good TV and education, they can afford it. But it's townships where it's really, really needed. Having said that, we need to see if the pilot works. I normally find it's better to kind of announce these things when at least you've had a pilot and you see whether it's working. And maybe a broader point, which is I think the big battle in future will be not between fiber and ADSL. It will be between mobile and fixed. And the new technologies that we're seeing on the mobile side, I'm talking we're at 4.9G now, but at 5G, they really are competitors to fiber. The speeds that you get, the throughput that you get, the capacity that you get. So we also have some thoughts around the township market and what we can do in the township market, in some cases with other partners that we want to do. So it's going to be an interesting battle. I do think the township markets will all be lit up in the next 3 years, some with fiber and some through the new age technologies that we are launching.
So it's not a case of either or, they'll coexist.
You could say in the long, long run, the capacity that a single strand of fiber has is incredible. But it comes with issues. You need to dig up pavements or you need to find poles to string it on. And again, the advantage that we have is mobility. People can move around and you don't have to dig in and so on. So it's going to come down to affordability. There will be a battle between the two, and both have their strengths and weaknesses.
Right. Michael, let's talk a bit about crypto money and cryptocurrencies and the blockchain. I know this is an area of particular interest. Firstly, as the CEO, or the former CEO rather, of a major bank, how do you see these technologies changing the financial services industry? Some people have suggested the blockchain could transform banks, perhaps even put them at risk as trusted intermediaries.
So I'm a fan of Bitcoin, of blockchain, and a whole lot of other cryptocurrencies, but also see their downside. So let's just start there. I think the whole concept of something being distributed is immensely powerful. And it's powerful because it takes away centralized institutions, which in some case have developed business models which take too much from the consumer. So in allowing payments, improving payments, they make it expensive. South Africans would say that our bank fees are not high. Now, that's very exciting from a consumer perspective. Having said that, customer inertia is high, much higher than people in South Africa give it credit for. I would say that the amount of transactions that are currently being done on Bitcoin in South Africa is quite small. I'm not talking about trades being done on the exchange or money passing hands because people are speculating it. I'm talking where people really pay for their coffee or for their groceries in Bitcoin. So I'm excited on the one hand, yet a little bit cautious about this incredible valuation run-up that we've seen. So even though I'm really, really excited about it, I mean, I've encountered very few asset classes that have gone up in such huge percentage terms. I'm asked nearly on a daily basis by people, you know, should they buy? What should they buy? And it always reminds me of that story that's told about the shoeshine boy outside the New York Stock Exchange. You know, when he asked the broker and said, what stock should he buy? The broker knew that a crash was coming and sold all his shares. So I just feel there's a bit of a frenzy right now. Now, it may carry on much longer because it's probably happening all over the world. But I'm making the point that one can be at the same time very excited about the blockchain backdrop to Bitcoin and yet have a little bit of skepticism about the valuations that you currently see.
Are you personally invested in any cryptocurrencies?
I was. Right now, I've scaled back my investments completely just because I can't cope with such dramatic price increases. Clearly, that gives me a bit of FOMO. And now that you see that, you know, they've gone up even more. But, you know, there's the inherent conservative nature of a banker. I don't mind if I'm wrong on this one. You know, it's been a good run.
Did you make a good profit out of it?
Look, I think anyone who's been involved in Bitcoin for more than 2 years, will say, you know, thank you very much to the inventors and that they got in early. Duncan, the thing is, it's so difficult to say what the actual value of a Bitcoin should be. You know, it's got a certain functional value for sure, like some other cryptocurrencies, and that you can, you know, buy and sell things for it and that the transaction costs aren't that high. Although, incidentally, they become much higher given that the transaction costs are also a function of the value. And, you know, that's one part of it. And secondly, you are speculating on the future of Bitcoin as a payment system. Now, it has huge potential. We know that. But it's also got a whole lot of other cryptocurrencies, some of whom I believe have better features. You know, Ethereum is better as a platform for smart contracts. I mean, I've tweeted before, there's another currency out there, IOTA. It's not that big. It's like seventh or eighth in the world right now. But it's completely free when you do transactions. It's completely scalable. You know, there's no limit to the amount of transactions that you can do per second. It can do small amounts, so it can power things like the Internet of Things when, I don't know, you want to put up a solar panel on your roof, but when you don't use the power, you want to sell it to your neighbor and the settlement can happen through IOTA. So I think there's even a battle for cryptocurrencies out there. But my conservative nature just says that the incredible run-up we've had in all these valuations seem dangerous to me. Certainly where I feel even stronger about it is in the market for ICOs, these initial coin offerings. It seems like every man and his dog is now doing an initial coin offer. People are investing in these things without even getting a stake in the ownership of the company. They have no, you know, equity in there. And I just think the rush that I'm seeing there means there will be tears sooner rather than later, I think.
Right. The banking industry is obviously very heavily regulated, and perhaps one of the advantages, probably also one of the disadvantages of cryptocurrencies is that they are pretty much unregulated. Do you think there's need for regulation of the space? Do you think it's desirable?
So it's interesting, Duncan. This is something I actually, you know, wrote my thesis about many, many years ago, is banking regulation. And it does have a good social reason for it. And that is that when banks fail, it has an incredible knock-on effect on society as a whole, particularly because people put their savings in banks, but also because without transactions, commerce can't happen. Now, the interesting thing about Bitcoin and blockchain is that from a payments perspective, it's actually secure. It does have some limitations, like you can't recall a transaction once you've done, But, you know, maybe those things will be sorted out in time. So from a payments perspective, I do think for the first time we have an alternative to normal national payment systems. From a depositors and savings and trust of money perspective, Bitcoin can't just go up one way the whole time. And the fluctuations and daily volatility is quite high. And right now, I don't feel that retail investors have an adequate understanding of the speculative nature of the value of Bitcoin. And, you know, some of them are going to lose money at some stage. Can't just go up all the time. And there, I do think regulation has a role to play for Bitcoin as an investment class. But the funny thing about regulators, and I really have sympathy for them, is, you know, we moan at them because, there are a lot of regulations and there is a lot of bureaucracy until something goes wrong. And then we're all it's quite easy for us to point our fingers in hindsight and think they should have and should have done things differently. So I think the main issue right now is just that I see an asset class which is has inflated very, very fast. And at some stage, people are going to lose money and then we're going to blame regulators. So I do see a role for them. Fortunately, for example, our Reserve Bank is playing quite a proactive role in actually even enabling interbank settlements using blockchain. So I think that's a very advanced regulator that is actually welcoming the trend.
Michael, I was interested in the term you used, alternative to the national payment system. I recorded a fascinating podcast a few weeks ago with the economist Russell Lamberti. He's a libertarian, and his views were that when money becomes anonymous and distributed in the way it is with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, it actually has the potential to change society. His view was that it could even undermine or even destroy the idea of central banking. It could do away with the ability of nation-state governments to collect tax. Looking longer term, do you think that this move into or the development of these cryptocurrencies has the potential to transform the way we work as a society?
I think Russell is right that, you know, depending on which cryptocurrencies do well, they have massive implications. So, for example, I said that if I can make a payment to you without having to involve a central party, i.e. a bank, as we've always done, you have to question whether you need banks. And the moment we start doing it in another currency, the central bank, which loses its power to issue a currency of its own, because, you know, there are now other currencies that compete with it that don't come from the sovereign, that don't come from the nation. Having said that, though, a currency like Bitcoin actually isn't anonymous. I mean, the anonymity, I think, is overplayed. It's a very public ledger. You don't always know who's behind the money, but you can see how it flowed. And in our world right now, you can also see where money went in. And if you want to cash it out to normal fiat currency, you can see where it goes out. So there are abilities still to regulate this. And the thing about regulation is sometimes it's overdone, but most often it's also done for the protection of consumers. So I think while regulation is probably going to lag innovation, it always does. You will find a balance ultimately between the advantages of cryptocurrencies and the disadvantage. Now, what is the disadvantage? The disadvantage is that the money, if truly anonymous and truly global, can be used for all types of illegal purposes, from arms to terrorism to assassinations to drugs, etc. And that's also a world that, while I have some libertarian tendencies, I also don't want.
Yes.
So, Duncan, so in summary, yes, these currencies technically can do just that, but I think like any new technology, it's up to us as humans to decide how we want to use those technologies, how we do want to regulate it, and in time, we will find the optimal balance.
Okay. Just lastly on this topic, I know that we touched on it, in fact, a bit earlier in this podcast, you've been quite critical of all the electricity that's wasted in creating some of these cryptocurrencies through mining, like the Bitcoin process. Are there alternatives? Are there other options?
Yeah, look, I think it's crazy. The latest estimate I see is that if the electricity that's used just to mine Bitcoin could power 1.5 million households.
Good grief.
To me, that seems like an incredible waste of energy, particularly in a globe where, you know, we're utilizing Earth's resources with too much abundance, where, you know, the last 5 years have been the hottest recorded. So I just think it's a pity. I spoke about one currency I like before, IOTA, which is free, doesn't need to be mined, uses a whole lot less electricity. And it's not just electricity, mind you, it's hardware. You have to think, to what other good purposes, societally good purposes, could that be utilized? So I suppose the one reason to be positive about Bitcoin is the incredible network effects that it has. From a functional perspective, there are other alternatives out there that one could argue are better. And, you know, personally, I just like the ones that aren't so heavy on electricity and hardware consumption.
Right. Michael Yudon, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast today. If anyone wants to get hold of you, you're quite a prolific tweeter. In fact, you run a very, very good Twitter account. The handle there is at Michael Yudon. If you don't really follow Michael, give him a follow on Twitter. Michael, thank you for joining us today. It's been a wide-ranging but fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Duncan. I also had fun.